honestly too many. I'm Hal Wolf, and I'm a retired ALC-LCA pastor, retired in January, and this is my 7th time on the faculty out here at Holden. My first time was back in 1962, when we were just sort of starting the place up. They had some people here in 61, but not too many. So really, 62 was one of the better years to say you start, help start it up. I taught in several seminaries, and that's probably one of the reasons why they said I should do some Bible study while I'm here. And as you heard at breakfast, today's my last time. In fact, I'm leaving at 10:30, so I'll go on the early bus. And we made it a tradition ever since 62 that we get off the bus halfway, just at the top of the switchbacks, and then we have lunch, and then we walk down the rest of the way. You know, the older you get, the more you like downhill. And, and I'm willing to admit I like downhill walking very much. But you get a better view that way, too. When you're walking uphill, you mostly have your feet down there, and your eyes and your feet together, trying to see where you're going to stumble or not stumble. We've been dealing for the last 2 weeks with a number of psalms. We started with Psalm 8, which was sort of an introduction to what is a human being. I used to call it what is man, because that's the way the psalm is translated. But you know, with ERA and all that stuff, I got to talk about something other, because it really says something about what are human beings, and most women count under. I've changed the translation. What is a human being is really the definition. And then the other side of the human being is the thing called sin. And Psalm 51 is a good illustration of sin. And then we talk about Psalm 103, which is probably the most frequently occurring type of psalm. It's a psalm of praise, a hymn, if you want to call it that. And that puts the setting. Psalm 103, 104, 105 all go together. The setting of the psalms in the relationship to God and with relationship to nature and relationship to history. And those three psalms fit together like that. We didn't cover all of them. And then we took up Psalm 50, which is an odd species yesterday, but it's an important one because it happens to be in some of the history and prophetic books. It's a covenant liturgy, or a renewal of the covenant psalm, if you want to put it that way. The popular title would be the trial scene, the great trial of the covenant people, probably annually, but we can't prove that for sure. Today we come to another one of the kinds of psalms that is the second most frequent, and these are laments, psalms of laments. They're both corporate and individual laments in the psalms. And Psalm 22 I always like to do because it's a great psalm. It has a great many things in it, but most Lutherans and Roman Catholics and most Western Protestants, the only part of it they know is the first verse. And so we're going to try to get you beyond the first verse today. I'm sometimes a slow Bible student, and I sometimes don't get a whole psalm done, but I'm going to try my best to get as far as I can on this, because toward the end, I want to suggest a few things about this psalm. The first week I was here, I gave a series of lectures on the Eastern Orthodox connection. I had to give some lectures in Cyprus the first 2 weeks in August, and it was an ecumenical conference, and I talked about the Eastern Orthodox connection. And one of the issues that the Eastern Orthodox could help Lutherans get is to get a concept of the theology of glory. Theology of resurrection. They like to talk about, they don't worship on Saturday, they say, and they don't worship on Sunday. They don't believe in seventh day or first day worship. They believe in eighth day worship. They believe they're worshiping on the eighth day. Now, just briefly to say that, and I'm not trying to give you three series of lectures in 1 hour, but what they're saying is that every time you go to the church, you're gathered with all the saints. You're really in heaven. You are the communion of saints, and the dead and the alive are all there. The whole history is there. All the martyrs are there. And it's the equivalent of the resurrection at the last day, not just thinking back to Easter or Pentecost, which is the way we Lutherans in our catechisms explain why we worship on Sunday. We say Christ rose on Sunday, Holy Spirit came on Sunday, the early disciples worshiped on Sunday. The Eastern Orthodox says that's not enough. you also are worshiping on the eighth day, which is the day in which Christ comes back again, and you joining with all the saints in heaven. So while we Protestants go to church and we gather together in order to go out and share and tell and mission and work and vocation, they gather in order to go up. And that's a concept that's new. Now, the reason I'm using that as an introduction is that's really what Psalm 22 is. Psalm 22 is a lament at the beginning and a victory song at the end. Psalm 22 carries the conflict which Lutherans and Eastern Orthodox, if they merge together theologically, could make sense of. And that is, the first 18 or 19 verses are a lament, a theology of the cross. Why am I a sinner? Why have you forsaken me? What's wrong with the covenant and all of that? But the rest of it is a theology of glory. You have rescued me. I have been saved. I do belong to you, and I'm quite confident that on the last day, or whenever you want to say it, we belong together. Now, I said yesterday, sort of as a teaser to come, that, you know, I'm going to say that most Good Friday sermons are blasphemous, except in the Eastern Orthodox Church. Western Roman Catholicism and most ecumenical services and all Lutherans, especially those who think they've got an old tradition about the seven last words of Christ, and they preach little homilies, maybe seven preachers or the same preacher seven times. Do you realize that it wasn't until the beginning of this century that we even knew the order of those seven, and we're still not sure? We don't even have any idea, because none of them occur in the same Gospels. You got to put them together like this in order to get them in order. Now, there's developed in the last 30 years, there's developed a tradition that this is first, this is second, this is third, and that sort of thing. And that's usually what you hear on Good Friday. But you very seldom on a Lutheran or a Roman Catholic Good Friday remember that there were no sermons on the seven last words of the cross until 1870. It's a modern invention. They read part of the gospel. They didn't even read all the seven last words. They read certain parts of the Gospels about Jesus' crucifixion in the East and in the West during the Middle Ages. They didn't preach on the seven last words. That's a very modern thing, and when people say we want to go back, and this is a long-standing tradition. And in the Eastern Orthodox Church, if you look at the Good Friday services and the hymns, you'll find glory is there. They know you can't separate the death of Christ from his resurrection. We do. The Roman Catholics have Stabat Mater, which is the Mary crying in front of the cross, standing there in front of the cross. And she never has any hope. The hymn ends after 26-some verses. She's still crying. O Sacred Head Now Wounded, a beautiful song. I have no objection to the song, except it doesn't finish off what is supposed to be finished. Christ won a victory on Good Friday. He didn't win it just on Easter. See, we don't time things like that. We do, but we shouldn't. Because in God there's no time, and in the Eastern Orthodox there's no time. So God won a victory. And it's all one victory. All together. Now some of you have heard, and some of you maybe like, and some of you dislike, the hymn. I'll call it a hymn, although it's a very popular song now, The Lord of the Dance. The Lord of the Dance talks about Jesus coming down as a babe in Bethlehem, and still they danced. And they hung him up on the cross rather high, and still he danced. And they couldn't kill him, and he was the Lord of the Dance. And that's the true Good Friday spirit. The Lord of the Dance and Psalm 22 are parallel in theology. You can't kill God. Christ was a Jew, among other things. And every good Jew knew his Psalms by heart. You know, just because we have bad memories and we look at books, you know, we've gotten so dependent, and I'm glad in a way someone's here who's blind who has to depend on her memory. You know, what you once learned are important to you, and very important. Whereas some of us who have not had the difficulty with our eyes, we don't use our memory as much. we depend on where can we look it up and we can read it. But they didn't have Bibles. Joseph didn't own a Bible. You know, they were expensive when you had to have them handwritten and written on papyrus or on parchment. So Jesus knew it. Now, I'm not the first one to say this beginning thing that I'm going to say now, and I'll get back to it at the end when we look at the Psalm specifically. But C.H. Dodd, who was a very fine New Testament scholar who wrote a Gospel of John commentary, said a long time ago, must have been 30 years ago, and people have missed it, especially seminary students and Lutheran preachers, that he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me, is not a theological treatise, which most of our sermons are when we end up preaching on that word from the cross. He uses a word, and I'm going to put it on the blackboard. It's a Latin word called incipit. Incipit is just a Latin fancy phrase for the first line or the first words. If you look at our red hymnal or our green hymnal, they have an index of first lines, don't they? If you went to a Baptist hymnal, you get a Baptist hymnal that has titles and first lines in it. But if you had in our hymnal only the titles of hymns, would you be able to find it? You probably wouldn't. Most of us couldn't. We know first lines, and that's how we find our hymns. So C.H. Dodd says that, and I'm going to develop it later, that my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Jesus' dying meditations on the cross included a number of psalms, being one of which was Psalm 22. But parchment was expensive for John and for the people who copied it. But every Jewish convert and every Jewish Christian knew those psalms. So all John had to do was record, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And they knew the 22nd Psalm. Just like many of you, we say the Lord is my shepherd, you know what the rest of it's going to be. But you don't know the rest of 22 because nobody told you. Nor you haven't read it recently. Now, I don't think Jesus was a dumb Jew. Most preachers make him very dumb, as if he didn't know what the end of that psalm was. He knew what the end of that psalm was. The end of that psalm was victory, deliverance, and glory. And I'll try to show you that very soon. Now, what C.H. Dodd is saying, in other words, is instead of writing down in the Gospel of John an entire psalm of 31 verses, that would have taken almost the equivalent of another chapter, right? At least one more page of expensive parchment. He put, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And whether Jesus said it all audibly, or whether only the first was audible, and then his strength got a little weaker, and he didn't say it quite as loudly or not, makes no difference, you see. Because John knew how the psalm came out. Rabbi Jesus knew how it came out. And surely the Son of God must have known how his word came out. So the next time you hear a pastor preach about all the reasons answering why, you know, my God, why? And that's where most of the preachers stop. And then they, because God doesn't know, the preachers know, and they answer it for you. We don't know why. It came out of God's love, period. And there's no other answer to it. We've got thousands of books written as to why God became man, why God died on the cross. But this psalm doesn't talk about that. This psalm only in the first. Now, let's just look at the structure of the psalm first. Two things about it. It begins with, my God. And the word God, when it's used in the psalms, usually means a power that isn't related to me except in punishment and fear. It's not the covenant God. It's not Yahweh, or as some bastard word, Jehovah, is used now and then. That's not even a Hebrew or a Greek word. It's just a make-up English word by a couple of illiterates who didn't know Hebrew, and they tried to figure it out, and there are a lot of other illiterates still use the word Jehovah. It just doesn't exist except in the figment of stupid imaginations. my God, in other words, we're talking about someone who hasn't made a covenant. And then you turn to verse 8, you've got the word for the covenant God, but it's not quoted by the psalmist who's lamenting. It's quoted by the scoffers, like those around the cross. And John was paralleling a little bit of this, you see. He committed his cause to Yahweh. He committed his cause to the four capital letter Lord. That's the best way of saying. Whenever you see L-O-R-D with four capital letters, it means the covenant God, which the modern Jewish scholars and the Jerusalem Bible just translates it. Yahweh, verse 8. He relied on Yahweh? Let Yahweh save him. If Yahweh is his friend, let Yahweh rescue him. Notice in quotations, it's said by the enemies or the scoffers of the guy who's in trouble. So the word Yahweh, the covenant God, is not taken because he feels I'm outside of the covenant now. I don't deserve to be in the covenant, and I guess God has temporarily forgotten me. So, verse 10, we're back to the word God all the way through. Verse 19, note, it looks like a paragraph if you have an RSV. They divide my garments among them, and for my raiments they cast lot. Space, paragraph, change of mood. From there on in, all the words for Lord are four capital letters. L-O-R-D. He appeals to the covenant God. The covenant God rescues him. He's going to tell the world about the covenant God, and he's going to make it real clear that this is what's happened. God has done it, is the last phrase in the passage. Now, back 200 years ago when they first started, I'm sorry I can't stay here for the next hour when Dan and David are going to deal with literary criticism. But 200 to 300 years ago, people used to say that the difference between the use of the name of God and the name of the covenant God indicated this is two psalms. The two psalms were stuck together somehow, and they weren't written by the same person, and they weren't composed, and they weren't even used in the old synagogues and the temples as one psalm. Because they were feeling their way around. What's a little clue that maybe the same author wrote it? Vocabulary is different. I use a different vocabulary than my father did. I use a different vocabulary than David Wee or Dan Erlander or Jim Fish use, or any of the pastors you know. We each have our typical things, and that's what they were saying. One person uses God, El, the powerful God. Another one uses Yahweh, the covenant God. We know that's not true anymore. It occasionally happens. It might be possible, but this is one psalm. It always has been one psalm. And the change in mood either takes place between 18 and 19 or between 20 and 21. Now, the editors of the RSV make the change take place between 18 and 19. If I were doing it, I would make the space of the new paragraph between 20 and 21, and I'll tell you why when we get there. But if you've read ahead or looked at this psalm at all, the mood is completely different after verse 19. And Jesus must have known that. John must have known that. But most Lutheran preachers don't on Good Friday. Now, they may know it, but they forget it on Good Friday. I shouldn't say they don't know it has an end. They all know it ends. But they've been so hung up for the last 109 years about a so-called order of the seven last words and hung up with given answers to why. You know, why did God become man? Why did God die on the cross? So, I need to quote something, not about the Psalms, but about what I've just said to you, and then I'll ask a few questions, then we'll go through the Psalm, and maybe I can convince you that what I'm saying makes some sense. In 1977, David Lockhead wrote a book called The Liberation of the Bible. One sentence from that. The Bible is an ideological captivity. Our goal is to liberate the Bible from our personal ideologies. Good Friday ideologies. 109-year-old traditions. That's an ideology. It's not necessarily a theology, although it can turn out to be a blasphemous theology. Some of you on the West Coast have heard of Robert McAfee Brown. He's down at Claremont, I think, in California. He wrote a book last year called Theology in a New Key. I'm going to read this sentence twice because I want you to really think about it. We read what we can bear to read. We hear what is tolerable to hear. And we evade or spiritualize those parts that leave us uncomfortable, if not outraged. End of quote. I'll read it again after I give an illustration or two. The Gospel of John has only one sacrament in it, baptism. It has the possibility of a second sacrament, foot washing. But Lutherans and Roman Catholics evade foot washing as a sacrament and say, oh, that was some kind of thing that the Pope does once a year. And Jesus did it for an allegory reason. But everything that we say is a sacrament is in chapter 18 of John. But we evade that. And then what we do, we go back to chapter 6, the feeding of the 5,000, and the whole series of I Am the Bread of Life bit, and say, there's John's Holy Supper. If the Eucharist was important to John, how come he skipped it? We say he didn't skip it. So we spiritualize chapter 6, I am the bread of life, or I fed the 5,000 kind of thing. And then we ignore the foot washing. Maybe the foot washing was his Lord's Supper, because it happened at the same meal, right? So maybe he didn't have to have the Lord's Supper, because everybody else had already told the story of the Lord's Supper. And so Passover, agape meal, foot washing, and Last Supper were a unit, and nobody did it. Now, before you ask a question, let me read McAfee Brown again, and then we'll have some questions, and then we'll go on to the psalm, believe it or not. We read what we can bear to read. You know, we usually read people who support us. We're always looking for arguments to say, we're right. And we don't want to get high blood pressure, so we don't read the other side. If we're Republicans, we mostly ignore Democratic writings, and vice versa. If we're communists, we usually don't read capitalists. And if we're capitalists, we don't read communist periodicals. And if we're pro-Israel, we don't want to listen to the PLO. And if we're very strong Arabs, we don't want to listen to Zionist propaganda. And see how we use the words? We read what we can bear to read. We hear what is tolerable to hear. And I like the next two verbs. We evade or spiritualize those parts that leave us uncomfortable, if not outraged. We have selective memories, selective vision, selective ears. That's part of the human condition of sin. We don't want to hear what makes us uncomfortable. We don't want to hear what makes us mad. Okay?
Well, I wasn't going to ask the question. I was just going to make a statement.
Sure, fine.
Washing of the feet. You say the Lutherans don't do it. Well, my daughter was at camp this summer.
Oh, well, I meant we don't do it as a sacrament. Sure, we did it here at Holden Village many times.
Well, they lift young kids and they wash feet
sure.
There.
A lot of churches and Lutheran churches are putting it back in. There's even an optional form for it that's suggested in the desk manual of the new Lutheran Book of Hymnal. Lutheran Book of Worship. It's possible, and we're beginning to recognize. No, you're right. It's been done. We did it here in 66, I guess, the first time, and they did it this summer again. It's getting to be a fairly good tradition here. But see, again, when we do it as a tradition like the statue over there on the altar, if you've seen it. It's a statue of Jesus with a basin and a towel. And it's usually used, and Carol Hinderly and other people have used the phrase, humble servanthood. And that's what we do with John's story. We don't make it a sacrament. We make it a symbolic act of divine stewardship and servanthood. And we act like it doesn't have to be repeated. But that's a whole other issue, whether it is or isn't a sacrament. Just saying, we maybe ought to think about it. Okay, let's see what we can do with this for fun. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me from the words of my groaning? And then you have some more groaning and some crying and a lot of other things. Remember, it's the non-covenant God. the God who judges, the God who creates, the God who has all the power. The word is Elohim, or El, and that's the God of strength. That's what the word means when it's used by itself, and that doesn't mean God, it means strength. To be forsaken by God means not only that he doesn't remember you, which you remember is a very good phrase in the Bible. What is man that thou art mindful of him, or that thou rememberest him? Remembering in the Bible always means doing something to save. It doesn't mean nostalgia about how it was back 55 years ago when I was confirmed. It doesn't have that kind of stuff. It has something to do with God's going to do something. I can remember something and just sit here in reverie. But God never does that. Roger Babson, a long time ago, says, whenever God's around, there's never a dull moment. Whenever God remembers, he does something. When he forsakes, he remembers and decides not to do something. So it's the opposite of doing something for us. He's not helped. And we can go on. I'm not going to spend a lot of this time, but those of you who were yesterday, remember that there was historic help in the covenant. We saved Moses, we got you out from Balaam, and we got you away from Balak, and you're better off than some of the other things. We rescued you in Psalm 50, it says. So here you've got between verses 4 and 5, you've got a historical allusion. If I can put it in my own words, it says, God, you delivered some of those rascals that were my ancestors. They weren't very good. How come you haven't taking care of me? How come you haven't delivered me from my enemies or my sickness or from falling over into the pit and death? I'm trusting you. At least I thought I did. I brought you all the sacrifices. That was in Micah as well as in Psalm 50 yesterday that we talked about. They cried and they were saved. Gosh, how I'm crying. How come I'm not being saved? I cry, and you know, isn't that an interesting thing about our own thing? This is why Luther says that the Psalms, we see into the heart of all God's children. He uses the word saints, but I've retranslated it. Because too many of us, when we say the word saints, we think of dead people and a Roman Catholic canonized saints, but we're all saints. Even if you don't like me, I'm a saint. You know, God thinks I'm a saint, whether you do or not. And that's an important Lutheran doctrine. So Luther puts it, let's see, that in the Psalms we look into the hearts of all the saints. That's the literal English translation. Isn't that what happens to you and me? And don't you know people who are saints, baptized Christians, who cry and cry and cry, and they don't have any more luck than Lady Macbeth getting rid of the spot and the sin and the thing that's bugging her? Or many more luck than St. Paul, if you want to be biblical. You know, he said, out damned thorn, and it never got out. That thorn in the flesh that he prayed for just didn't go away. So this guy, or gal, or group, we don't know. It's in the first person, I. So what he does is does what many Westerners do all the time. You get a logical conclusion. Our fathers were sinful human beings. They cried and trusted, and they got saved. I'm a sinful human being. I cry. I think I'm trusting. I'm not getting saved. Therefore, my assumption and premise must be wrong. And that explains verse 6. We Lutherans push verse 6 too much. You know, we say, I am a worm and no man, scorned by men and despised by the people. What he's really saying is, if I were really a child of God and a human being, God would deliver me. God hasn't delivered me, honestly, a mouse. Some of the ladies were worried about mice and cornea this morning. You know, so, you know, I must be a mouse. And that's why people scorn me and come down here to sleep instead of in their beds. All kinds of things, you know, we can do. If God delivers human beings and I'm not delivered, I must be less than a human being, right? Isn't that perfectly good Western logic? Maybe I'm not a worm. Maybe just say I'm a pig. Or I'm a dog. Dog comes up here later in a few minutes. You follow the logic he's saying. I cried, I cried, I cried. I trusted, I trusted, I trusted. I prayed, I prayed, I prayed.
Everybody else I know that did that, even those lousy people like Jacob, and some of those people like David and Absalom and Tamar, and all those pornographic people, he delivered them. I must be no count. And so he put himself down. Everybody who sees me mocks at me. They laugh, they make faces at me, they wag their heads, make mouths at me. It's probably, we ought to translate, they stick out their tongues at me. You know, we just don't want to get those images. Or maybe they, do you see that? I'm so pure of them, I didn't want to do it, but I'll do it anyhow. You know, they do that to you. They make faces at you. And they thumb their noses at you. You know, it just has a problem with me. All who see me mock me, they make notes. And note, it's their quotation, and only theirs, that uses the word covenant God in these first 18 verses. He committed his cause to the Lord. Let the Lord deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. That's sarcasm, isn't it? He delights in him. That can go either way. Whichever pronouns you want to put, it doesn't make any difference. What does the he refer to? Lord? The Lord delights in this character who's complaining all the time? Or does it mean this complainer delights in the Lord? Look how he delights. You can go either way with that, because the Hebrew isn't clear. It's just like English. If a pronoun has an antecedent but isn't clear, you got to take your choice. You got to make a pick. I happen to think it refers to the Lord as the, you know, let the Lord deliver you. Let the Lord rescue you. For the Lord really loves you. You can take it the other way, too. Now the guy has a little bit of hope. Just a little bit. In the God of power, in the God of creation. He says, God, why did you let me get born? If you're going to let me die so soon, why did you have me born? You're the one. Remember, the God is the God that's talking about a power, and the God of creation, the God of nature. You're the one who took me from the womb. You kept me safe upon my mother's breast. Upon you I was cast at my birth, and since my mother bore me, you have been my God. Long before circumcision, long before baptism, if we want to bring it into Christianity, you are the God who was around, took care of my mother. This is very similar to what Psalm 51 says, and again, where we get all mixed up about, I have been a sinner from my mother's womb, or my mother conceived me in iniquity and in sin. I was born in iniquity and in sin did my mother conceive me. All being said in 51 is, I've always been a sinner. Now, this is saying in another way, I've always been a child of this kind of God. How come he isn't delivering me? Isaiah 48 says the same thing. I've been from my mother's womb a child of God. God delivered me. Jeremiah says something like that. What's wrong with you, God? You let me be born. You let my mother survive. You even let me be lifted up. In Ezekiel and many of the other childhood customs of ancient times, a father acknowledges child immediately after birth by taking the child, holding it up, having it salted, and putting it in its lap. That was accepted, that it's my child. And it's not a child of adultery, or that I got too many and I'm going to give this one away to the wolf. It was a symbolic act of saying, this is my child. Because in those days they didn't have paternity tests to try to prove it, so he did it this way. He showed this was my child, my family child. And so you allowed that. So he tries once more. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. Many bulls encompass me, strong bulls of Bashan, and Bashan was mentioned in other places around me. They open wide their mouths at me like a roaring, raving lion. The conquerors, whether the conquerors are spiritual or physical diseases or illnesses, or whether the conquerors are national and military, doesn't make any difference. You can go either way. If this is a complaint of the eye stands for the king who is being surrounded by enemies, and the eye stands for the king and the whole community, the enemy could be the Assyrians, could be the Persians, it could be the Babylonians, it could be the Egyptians, who knows. If it's not that, and it's just a guy who's sick and he's afraid to die, like Psalm 16 and Psalm 51, it's just illness. He may have leprosy, he may have their equivalent of cancer. You know, somebody said that we see so much cancer now because all we've done is exchange bubonic plague for cancer. Bubonic plague killed off a lot of people, and you never lived old enough to get cancer. Now we got rid of bubonic plague, so we got cancer. We get rid of cancer, and we'll all die at 100 or something, some other disease. You know, we aren't really immortal. And many doctors have a problem with that. They think we ought to be immortal, and that they ought to be God Almighty to keep us all living forever, isn't it? It's tough on some doctors. Okay, then we get a picture which John uses a little bit, and I'm going to come back to it the last 5 minutes. A picture of a dying person. He could be dying on a cross, he could be dying of some debilitating disease, he could be dying out on the desert, whether it's the Sahara or the Syrian desert, or whether it's just the deserts of California, the Mojave. I'm poured out like water, all my bones are out of joint, my heart is like wax, it's melted within my breast. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, my tongue cleaves to my jaws, thou dost lay me in the dust of death. I don't know whether I'd want an open casket if I looked like that. Pretty good picture, isn't it? Those of you who have some imagination, those words really say a lot, don't they? You know, I'm debilitated. All the water, all the muscle, all the fat out of my face. My bones are, you know, I look worse than somebody who has had a bad case of infantile paralysis, or some of the handicapped people that Jerry Lewis tries to help, both multiple dystrophy and multiple sclerosis and some of the other diseases and the cerebral palsy people. You know, with any image you want that makes it feel tough to you, pick it up. Maybe he's fallen out of an airplane. Oh, they didn't have airplanes then, did they? But anyhow, figure what somebody's going to look like when they fall in the desert out of an airplane. You know, and you got a pretty good picture here. My heart is like wax that's melted within my breast. Normally, heart in the Old Testament doesn't mean St. Valentine's Day kind of heart and emotion. It usually means my thinking process. I'm out of my head. That's what he's saying here. I'm delirious. You know, I'm seeing mirages all over the desert as I'm trying to find my way back to the water. Or whatever scene you want. The picture is very clear. My heart is like wax means, we would say, like a water on the brain. Or I'm out of my head. That's a better translation, it really is. Just because it melts in your breast doesn't mean you're not talking about intellectual capacity or lack of it. Because they don't know the word brave. You got to remember, this is long before Harvey discovered circulation of blood. It's long before people knew that the brain up here was the seat of a great many things, emotions as well as intellect. And we only have just in the last 10 years decided that this side has to do with intellect and this side has to do with emotion and intuition. And they're still arguing that. The neurosurgeons don't agree with the psychiatrists, so we'll have a fight on that for another 20 years until somebody decides they won. I don't know who's going to win that one yet. I know where I'd like to be, which side I'm on, but my side doesn't always win. I guess maybe I had to cry to the Lord, shouldn't I? Because the human situation is I want my side to win, whether it's the Cincinnati Reds or whether it's the California Angels. The dogs around me, a company of evildoers encircle me. Let's just take that. Dogs normally in the Old Testament means foreigners. So that's a slight hint that maybe these are national psalms and have something to do with the national enemy of a king and the people. But you know, they could also be talking literal. You know, if I'm dying, the dogs and the vultures are coming around. Company of evildoers. That sounds like human beings, so I tend to think this is a national calamity, but you can't prove it. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. And then John picks this passage up, you remember. They divide my garments among them, and for my raiments they cast lots. Now, some pastors get that far into the text when they're preaching on Good Friday, because John tells them to. Because in John's story, he talks about the soldiers taking the seamless robe and casting lots over it. So that's picked up. Now change, look at the mood. As I say, we can change it at verse 19 or we can change it at verse 21. I'm going to leave the first verse 19 and 20 the way they are. The guy who's almost dead tries one more time. And this time he dares take the name of the Lord of the covenant. He says, "But O Yahweh, O God of the covenant, O Lord, be not far off." There's a little glimmer of hope that he dares use this name. Remember, he hasn't used it for 20 verses almost, not 18 verses. "Deliver me," and I really want to say me. He's not saying my soul, because in Hebrew, there was no such thing as a soul. There were only living beings. Genesis 2:7 and Ecclesiastes 12:7 all make it quite clear that I don't have a soul, I am a soul. That when God, the Spirit, was over, he breathed into the dust, and man became a living being, is the translation that most of you have seen now. Man didn't get a soul. And in Ecclesiastes, after they tell how old I am, and my teeth are falling out, my hair is falling out, and I'm supposedly not sexual anymore, and all these things are happening to me, and then they're going to break the pitcher at the fountain, and then it says, "Before the dust returns to the dust from whence it came, and the spirit goes back to God who gave it." Spirit is not soul, although many people for years have read it that way. Spirit is the life-giving power of God. So when God pulls the spirit out, or pulls the rug out, if you want to use another image, I ain't. I'm dead. And when the resurrection happens, he doesn't pour something back in to the bottle or the genie or laminate a couple of pieces of plywood, body and soul together. He just revivifies me. He makes me all over. That's why I don't have to worry about glorified body or gathering up the pieces from cremations or from automobile accidents or explosions or from nuclear holocausts or whatever. God doesn't depend on that his power brings me back. So, O Lord, the covenant God, be my help, hasten to my aid, deliver me from the sword, my life from the power of the dog. If you have a King James, you got that beautiful word, deliver my soul from the sword, my darling from the power of the dog. That's an old Shakespearean King James phrase when they thought the soul was the darling of my heart. Now, we've translated the darling of my heart to my wife or my girlfriend or my loved one or something of the sort. So darling's gotten moved since Shakespeare's time into something else. So if you've still got a King James in front of you, you know, that really isn't what it says. It's not talking about darling. Psalm 103 gives you the answer to that one, too. Bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me. Bless his holy name. Things that are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Soul is all that is within me. All of me is supposed to bless him. Some of us have talked about how long ago we were confirmed, and I guess almost that long ago, there was a Torch song, "Come and Take All of Me." Some of you are old enough to remember that Torch song, maybe even sang it to your boyfriend or your girlfriend. "Come and take all of me." And you just didn't mean take a soul. You didn't just mean take sex organs either. You meant take all. You meant the whole thing. The whole shooting match, to use a little bit more modern term, but still old-fashioned. And that's what soul and life and darling all mean. Now, your translation at verse 21 and verse 21 is still part of the imperative prayer. Second person singular and imperative in English are the same form, aren't they? Save me and thou shalt save me. Those are very similar in other languages too. So you could say this is still part of the prayer. Save me from the mouth of the lion,
my afflicted soul from the horns of the wild oxen. And then you'd have to have deliverance happen in the blank space between 21 and 22. Because in 22, what are you going to tell? I will tell the name to my brethren. I've been delivered. I've been saved. I'm not dead. They can't count my bones anymore. I'm not thirsty anymore. I'm not hungry anymore. The enemies have been dispersed. So either you've got to put it in the blank space between 21 and 22, or you got to do what my friend in the Anchor Bible does. Mitchell Dahoud is a Jesuit, and it's a technical book, but if your church library has the Anchor Bible, you might want to look up the Anchor Bible on Psalms. It's three volumes, and Mitchell Dahoud is probably one of the best Old Testament and Canaanite scholars in the world. A friend of mine who just retired 3 months before I did from the Presbyterian Church near us went over to Rome this past year and worked with Mitchell Dahoud, because he's working on the Eblah tablets, which you probably read about in Time and Newsweek, and a lot of references to biblical names and biblical places from about the year 1500 BC that were found in northern Syria. And Mitchell Dahoud is one of the ones helping to translate that. Now, Mitchell Dahoud does a few things, and I happen to agree with him, not because he's a friend or because we studied under the same professor or anything like that, because I think it makes sense Hebrew. First of all, look at the second half of the verse, my afflicted soul from the horns of the wild oxen. Look at your footnote. My RSV has a little O there. And it says, that's the Greek and the Syriac translation, my afflicted soul. But look what it says the Hebrew really says. Can anybody read that fine print? If you're as old as I am, you have to struggle sometime. I can still read it, but somebody read the footnote O in the RSV.
Thou hast answered me.
Thou hast answered me. You know, it's no longer an imperative prayer. It's a statement of a fact. The literal Hebrew says, thou hast answered me from the horns of the wild oxen. Any of you remember how the altar looked in the Temple of Solomon? What did it have on the four corners? Anybody remember?
The bulls?
Yeah, well, it had horns. It had the horns of the altar. So the horns of the wild oxen are sort of saying from the horns of the altar. If you remember the book of Leviticus, the book of Leviticus says that even if you murdered somebody, you could take refuge if you got to the temple before anybody else did and grabbed onto the horns. And nobody could catch you. It was like a Russian taking asylum in the American embassy in Moscow. You know, that's American soil. And so the Russians can't come in and take them out. So when somebody grabs onto the horn of the altar in the book of Leviticus or in the history books later on, you can't take them out and punish them. So what's it say? Thou hast answered me from the horns of the altar. You delivered me. Okay, now take the beginning. You follow what we're saying? This is what the Hebrew says. I don't know why they decided to take the Hebrew, or the Greek, and the Syriac, where it says, my afflicted soul. The RSV I like because of the word steadfast love, which it invented. It's a beautiful word, beautiful double word. It's much better than loving kindness. It says so much more. But the RSV, you've got to remember, was a translation by a committee. And when it came to words or versions or what they take, majority vote ruled. And sometimes you got a translation here that was voted on 51-50. That doesn't mean it's right, you know. Whether it's biblical translation or whether it's a vote in the Senate, you live by it, because that's the way we work. But that doesn't necessarily make it right. Okay? And I'm getting a little off. So, Dahoud says, instead of saying, save me, you now parallel it with the Hebrew of the second half, thou hast answered me, and just simply say, thou hast saved me. Absolutely no change is necessary in the Hebrew to translate it that way. Absolutely none. Thou hast saved me from the mouth of the lion. Thou hast answered me from the horns of the wild oxen. If that isn't delivery, if that isn't rescue, if that isn't victory, I don't know what is. It's as clear as possible. And if you don't want to change that English translation, you've got to say it happened between verse 21 and 22 anyhow. Because the rest of it says, I will tell of your name to the brethren. I'm going to praise everybody. I'm going to, verse 25, I'm going to tell the whole congregation. I'm going to pay my vows. All the ends of the earth shall remember the covenant and commandments of the Lord. Everybody's going to be converted. Why? Something has to happen. Now you see where we miss it on Good Friday? Look how joyous the last 10 verses are. For dominion belongs to the Lord. I've won. Christ has conquered the devil, the world, and the flesh, Luther said. And we act on Good Friday as if it ain't over. He hasn't conquered anything yet. That he's still up there suffering and crying for the next 3 hours. My God, why has he forsaken me? He didn't keep on going that long. He was saying a very nice Hebrew prayer. Posterity shall serve him, and men shall tell of the Lord to the coming generations, and proclaim his deliverance to a people yet unborn. New Testament, church history, now till the end of the world. That he has wrought it. That he has done it. He did it. With his own mighty hand, he did it. Or with his humble suffering and death, he did it. I don't care which phrase you want to use. But he did it, right? Now, here's the first thing where I want to throw you a little bit. If God is right, and Jesus was doing his dying meditation by reciting some of the Psalms to himself on the cross, and John didn't want to waste parchment for writing out all these 31 verses, it's possible, and Dodd doesn't go as far as I do, so you don't have to agree with me, but I'll tell you what Dodd says. Dodd says the crap that you hear on the pulpit from about it is finished should be forgotten completely. It's merely a statement of Jesus saying, I'm done my meditations. It's like, amen. I'm finished praying, God. I go further than that because I think I can prove it. The words, look at the last words. He has wrought it. The same Hebrew word is used for accomplished, fulfilled, performed, kept, and finished. Remember, Jesus is saying this in Hebrew, right? He has done it. He and it are not distinguished in Hebrew or many languages. So he has done it, or it is finished. Not much difference, is there? I could do it a couple of other passages. We're running out of time, but let me just show you one. Turn to Ezekiel chapter 12. There are several others where this is the same Hebrew word that I want you to look at. Ezekiel chapter 12. The word, of those of you who are pastors or who have had a little Hebrew, the word is asah. S-A-H is the best way of writing it. Ezekiel 12. Look at verse 11. I'll read it. Say, I am a sign for you, as I have done, so shall it be done to them. They shall go into exile, into captivity. I have done is the first person. It be done, so shall it be done. Same word. You know, so if Jesus says, it is ashad, it is done, it is finished, it is wrought, he has wrought it, they're saying the same thing, aren't they? It's quite possible that he isn't saying, I'm finished my meditations. It's just that John, or one of the other gospel writers who put down, it is finished, I've forgotten whether it's John or somebody else, because they really, each one has a different set of words. Very few of them repeat them. This guy, who got it from a witness, who heard it in Hebrew, translated it into Aramaic, and then somebody put it into Greek. By the time you go from Hebrew to Aramaic to Greek to English, the word asa could have all kinds of possibilities. But if I've done it, if I've done my job as a Bible leader here for 3 weeks, I'm finished, right? If I've performed, which is another translation for this word, if I've performed, I'm finished, right? So my theory is, I can't prove it, but my theory is that he has done it. And when the people heard the phrase in Hebrew, "He has done it," it got translated, "He has finished it." Because it's past tense in a way. It's all over. The victory is here. It's all done. Now, just the last one, you've already heard me push. I also think that when they heard him get to verses 14 and 15, and by the time they heard him mumble a little bit about my strength and my throat is dried up like a potsherd, somebody said, gosh, the guy's thirsty. You know, some of them thought he was wanting some vinegar because he was thirsty. And somebody else said they heard him say, "I thirst." Some heard the, my God, why hast thou forsaken me," which is the first part of 22, as "Eli, Eli," meaning he's calling on Elijah. So obviously some of those guys had bad hearing, like the guy over there from Alaska last night, learning about bananas and bandanas. You know, and by the time you put too many bananas in your ears, you don't hear very well. And plus the emotion of watching your favorite son die, like Mary did. You know, you could mishear, right? You don't always hear exactly. So Eli, Eli became, he's calling on Elijah, and they do all kinds of things, and then "I thirst," and they give him vinegar. Well, again, you could either say parchment or he really said. Listen to it. The word in verse 15, "My strength is dried up like a potsherd." The word "strength" also is translated in the Hebrew Bible and other places. "My throat is dried up like a potsherd."